Hear another parable. There was a master of a house who planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower and leased it to tenants and went into another country. When the season for fruit drew near, he sent his servants to the tenants to get his fruit. And the tenants took his servants and beat one, killed another, and stoned another.
Good morning. We're going to continue our series today from the book of Matthew. We're looking at the crimes of Jesus of Nazareth, which we know is a deliberately confusing and misleading title, so let me explain what we mean by that. In the book of Matthew, in the 21st chapter, you see this scene where Jesus enters the city of Jerusalem, and they say, "Hosanna to the Son of David," and they lay down their coats and the branches and palms, and he enters in, and it seems like they have a rich and optimistic expectation of what Jesus will do next. On Friday of that same week, Pilate says, "Well, which one will you have me release to you?" And they say, "Give us Barabbas." And he says, "Well, what will I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" And they say, "Crucify him, crucify him." I think sometimes that we forget that the first ending of the story of Jesus, it's a unique story in that it has two endings. There's one that man wrote and one that God wrote, if you want to think of it that way. The first ending of the story of Jesus ends with his crucifixion and death. Crucifixion, capital punishment. They put him to death. They coerced a Roman governor into sanctioning it, Roman officials into carrying it out, and they executed Jesus. What did Jesus do? If we have a view of Jesus and his teachings which is so bland and smoothed out, which is so palatable, which makes us comfortable and warm and fuzzy in our hearts, that's one view of Jesus, but it's not a very crucifiable Jesus. It's not the kind of Jesus that somebody would want to kill. And yet that's exactly what they do. And they do a good job of it. They come by night with torches to take him away. They want him dead. He is a threat to their position and power. So our question is, what did Jesus do? And our case has been that the charges we would level against Jesus if we understood him better mostly amounts to him teaching things that we would find equally uncomfortable if we pause to listen. And so this morning we're going to look in Matthew, the 21st chapter, once again, at a story Jesus told that begins in verse 33, and I need to give my familiar disclaimer. This is a parable that Jesus is going to tell, and I am quite convinced the only way that you can understand a parable of Jesus is to forget that you've ever heard it before. Because it's kind of like a joke. I don't mean that it's funny, but just follow with me. The structure's like a joke. Once you know the punchline, it's not as funny. What makes a joke funny? It's that you didn't see it coming. At the end, it surprises you. There's a turn, and you go, "Oh, well, I didn't expect that at all." Maybe it's a very ordinary question, but it has an unexpected ending to it. Parables are very much like that. They're very ordinary stories when they start out, and they kind of lull you to sleep and say, "Okay, yeah, I'm with you. I'm tracking along." And then out of nowhere, you get this turn that surprises you and is the lesson we're supposed to take with us. So if you've already heard this parable, and quite possible that you have, it's hard to get that first-time sensation again. This parable we're going to read today is sometimes called the parable of the wicked tenants. So I'm going to change the parable title to start with, because that gives away the ending, right? He doesn't start off by saying, "Let me tell you about the bad guys." This is a parable of tenant farmers. It's a parable about farmers. Now, if you'll start there with me and read this story, I think, and if you can forget for a moment how you think it ends, everything you know about it will still be there when we're done, but just set it aside for a moment and hear it again for the first time, I think it can be beneficial to you. We often hear this as a parable of judgment. The bad guys get it in the end. In fact, a lot of folks have just seen it as a criticism of the Jewish people who crucified Jesus. During World War II, this was a favored parable among some of the German leaders who saw it as justification. We should get rid of the Jewish people because of what they did to Jesus. And that's the way they read this parable. This is a parable of judgment against Judaism. But if you'll listen carefully and could hear it again for the first time, I think you will hear something worth understanding. Verse 33 begins like this: "Hear another parable. There was a master of a house who planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower and leased it to tenants and went into another country. When the season for fruit drew near, he sent his servants to the tenants to get his fruit. And the tenants took his servants and beat one, killed another, and stoned another." First observation about this text is that this is not a purely hypothetical story. This is not just fantasy and make-believe at this point. Tenant farming is a real thing. Oklahomans, out of anybody, ought to get this. We understand what farming is about, I hope. We still have this cultural memory of what it's about. And the bitterness of being a farmer after a bad year. You know how this works, right? Your family has owned land for generations, and it's been handed down from father to son. And you work the land, and you know the land. You know where the trees are. You know where they were when they were little saplings. You know where the creeks run. You know what the dirt smells like. This is our land. And it's your turn. And your family lives on it, and you work it. You work it honestly. And it's how you provide for your family and provide for your community. You're a good man. You go to church. You give away your extra crops to people who are in need. One year, you have a bad year. It happens. You have a bad year and the crops don't come in. And you find out, instead of having extra, you're the one in need. You don't have enough to provide for your family. You definitely don't have enough to buy seed for next year. So you go down to the bank and they understand. Farmer Jones, we understand. We completely understand. We're going to give you a mortgage on your land. We're going to advance you some funds, and you're going to go buy the seeds you need to start over next year. And so you do that. At that point, of course, your tractor breaks. Why? Because tractors break. That's what they do. They were made to break. So the tractor breaks, and you go down to the bank again, and you say, "The tractor's broke. I've got the seed. My tractor's broke." And they say, "Don't worry, Farmer Jones. We're going to advance you some money." And so you go out on your field, your mortgaged field, with your borrowed seed and your mortgaged tractor, and you plant again in faith. And you have another bad year, because they don't just come one at a time. You have another bad year, and you go to the bank, and you know the bank, nice folks that they aren't as understanding this time as they were last time. "Actually, Farmer Jones, we were hoping you could start paying back last year's loan, and you need more." So they extend to you a little extra. And next year, you're going to get better, and you go out there, and you plant it again, and you have a third bad year. And you don't understand why, but you understand exactly how you feel. You're bitter. You're angry because you did your part like your fathers had before you, and you have nothing to show for it. You went to church and you said your prayers, and the ground just isn't doing its job. And what happens to the land that's been in your family for generations and the tractor that you had to buy? Don't worry about it. The bank has a plan for that. A nice man shows up at the front gate, and he has a piece of paper of repossession. Sheriff's with him. This property and its loan and its debt has now been bought by a investor from out east somewhere. And here's the good news, Farmer Jones. It's really good news. He's going to buy your property. He's going to pay off your debts. He owns this land now, but he doesn't actually want to farm it. He's an investor, not a farmer. And so here's the good news, Farmer Jones. You get to stay here. You get to live in the same house you grew up in, and you get to work this land again and again for somebody else. It's not your land anymore. For a small share of the crop, you can be paid to work the land. Bitter. Some guy that's never seen it owns it. And here I am, who's worked this land with my father and his father's father before him, work it for a piece of the crop, all because I had a couple of bad years. Bitter. That's what tenant farming is about. This story is a parable about a man who puts together a field, and he makes some fairly expensive improvements. He builds a tower. He puts a hedge around it. He builds the walls. He has no interest in working it himself. He's going to go off into a foreign country. He's going off. This is an investment for him. And so he hires some tenants. Do you know how this story sounded to the Jewish ear when they heard it? It sounded like their life. Because this wasn't just their land, this was the land of their forefathers going back to the time of Joshua. 1,500 years, Palestine had been their land, given to them by God. And Rome comes down, and they said, no, we think that's our land now. And it now belongs to Roman governors and Roman investors. But good news, folks, you can stay and work the land for us. Work our land. Bitter. Every tenant farmer's fantasy was to do what this story is about. What if we just took it back? They're not here. We never see them. What if we just said, we did all the work. We're going to keep the crop. This year we're going to keep it all, and we kept it all. And a little blood has to be shed, but that's all right. They're foreigners anyway. This is our land. Grandma's buried out back. This is where we live. Rebelling against the landowner is every tenant farmer's fantasy, especially one who had lost his land in the way that the Jewish people had lost theirs. And we all love a good rebel story, right? This one's for Matt Caldwell, just for you. You are part of a rebel alliance and a traitor. In the Star Wars universe, who are the good guys? The rebels. The rebels are the good. We love a good rebellion story. We think that's the best, right? We love it when the rebels win. So what does Jesus tell? He tells a story about farmers. Farmers who rise up and say, this belongs to us and we'll have it back now, thank you. And they kill the foreign investor's servants. In fact, it almost sounds messianic. This sounds a little bit like what they were expecting the Messiah to do. The Messiah is going to come back and he's going to reclaim our land from the Romans. He's going to give it back to us. He's going to sit on David's throne and kick the Romans out and this will be ours again. He tells the story and they say, yeah, go get them. Do you understand that in this story up to this point, the tenant farmers are the good guys? It's the one that the audience would have identified with the most and said, yes, I can get on board with that. Maybe it's not the nicest thing to do, but we could understand that. It almost sounds messianic. In verse 36, again, he sent other servants. More than the first, and they did the same to them. Finally, he sent his son to them, saying, they will respect my son. But when the tenants saw the son, they say to themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and have his inheritance. And they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Now, can I ask some questions about this part of the story? Because I think this is where things start to get a little unsettled, I think, when you're reading the story. Something happened right here that doesn't track. The first part of the story, you say, I get it. Tenant farmers, rebellion, violence. Yeah, go get him. And then this thing happens. He keeps sending more servants. You know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. They killed the first round of servants. All right, your turn, you go. You know, I'm not signing up for that job real fast. If I'm the servant, I'm going to take a sick day, send somebody else. I know what happened to the other guys. And then the landowner says, well, I know what will fix this. I'll send my son, the person who is dearest and most precious in the world to me. Clearly, they'll respect that. Fair question, is the landowner a fool? What is he thinking? They've killed everyone you sent repeatedly. It wasn't a mistake. They got it exactly the way they wanted to. You did it again. They killed them again. And you say, well, it's time to send my son. I think part of us says that's not a real good idea. I think if you're the son, maybe it might be time to say, is this a good idea? I think it's the question I'd ask. I don't think I'm a coward, but I've got to tell you, if they've already killed two rounds of servants and Dad says, it's your turn, Ben, I'm thinking, you know, maybe there's another solution to this problem. How about a letter? Right? Maybe not me. Is the father a fool? Is the son a fool? But more than that, we can ask this next question. Are the tenant farmers fools? Both of these people act out of a drastic misunderstanding of what's going on in the situation. The landowner thinks that the problem is respect. I just haven't sent anyone important enough yet. As if they killed the servants the first time around just because, you know, they weren't the son, right? That doesn't make any sense. But that's the way the landowner thinks. They will respect me. Clearly they respect me. They couldn't be bitter and hostile towards me. The murdering of my servants couldn't be the fact that they hate me. Couldn't be that. So I'll send them my son, and this will go over better. They just must not have gotten along very well with the two rounds of servants I've already sent. He misunderstands the situation, doesn't he? But so do the tenant farmers. The tenant farmers see the son coming, and what do they say? This is the heir. If we kill the heir, we get the land back. What are they thinking about? They're stuck in their old ways. This is the way the land had been passed down, from father to son to father to son. And they see the heir and they say, maybe this is it. Maybe this is how we get it back. Does anybody actually think this is how it will work? Be serious now. If you kill an investor's son, do you suddenly get his investment? See, the foreign landowner doesn't view this as your inherited property that he's just holding for you until he runs out of people to give it to. This is property he owns, he's purchased, he's invested in. It's his. Killing his son doesn't get you anything, but they're thinking in the old ways. There's the heir, we'll kill the heir, we'll get the land. Both groups of people, everyone in the story seems to be misunderstanding what's going on in the story. Which leads us then to Jesus' question in verse 40. When therefore the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to these tenants? That's the question. Now notice the question again. The question is not, who's the hero in this story? The question isn't, did they do right? The question isn't, did the owner of the land deserve it? Did he have it coming? The question isn't even my questions. Are these guys out of their minds? The question is, finish the story. What happens next? And they knew the answer to this story because they had lived it. This is not hypothetical. The Jewish people had rebelled against their foreign landowners many times. False messiahs and would-be messiahs had come along in the years before Jesus and said, "Follow me and we'll throw off the Romans." And they knew how that ended. I mean, we have the statues. This little relief here on the picture is actually a depiction of Roman soldiers returning. See the menorah and the different instruments? It's a depiction of Roman soldiers coming back from Palestine after wiping them out one more time. The Romans had gotten pretty good at it. The Jewish people rebel and say, this time it's going to work. And what do the Romans do? They say, oh, well, okay. No, they come and wipe them out, take all their stuff and go back to the Rome, and they make sculptures of it. They were good at it. This wasn't hypothetical. What happens when the tenant farmers rebel against their Lord over and over and over and over? Eventually someone gets sick of it. And so the Jewish leaders give the answer. It doesn't matter how sympathetic they are to the cause of the tenant farmers. They know what the right answer is. And in verse 41, they say to him, "He will put those wretches to a miserable death and let out the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the fruits in their season." I'm not sure what all the translations have there. I don't think the word wretches is a demeaning word. I don't think the Jewish leaders are saying, "He will put those wicked men to death." I think they're saying, "Those poor fellows are going to get put to death. Those wretches, they don't stand a chance." Those wretches, poor tenant farmers, despised by the world and put down by their society, are going to be put to a miserable death. They will be executed, they will be crucified, they will be killed in every heinous way Rome could imagine, and all of the stuff they fought for will be taken back and handed off to somebody else, because there's always somebody hungry who will work the land for you. This isn't hypothetical. They knew how this story ended. Jesus tells the story and they immediately know the answer in detail. You notice sometimes in the scriptures, Jesus asks a question and they give a vague answer. This is not a vague answer. This is one they had seen. He will put those wretches to a miserable death. They know how this story ends. What they don't understand is what Jesus is going to do about it. They know the answer, but not liking the answer is not the same as changing it. So here is Jesus' response in verse 42. Jesus said to them, "Have you never read in the scriptures? The stones that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing its fruit. And the one who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush him. When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard this parable, they perceived that he was speaking about them. Sometimes at the end of parables, people say we have no idea what it's talking about. This is not one of them. At the end of this parable, people knew exactly what he was talking about, and they didn't like it. I told a preacher friend of mine the sad truth of teaching morality. I said, sometimes the people who don't like your sermon are the only people who understood it. Jesus told this parable, and the Pharisees said, hey, wait a second. You're talking about us. They didn't like it. What did Jesus actually tell them? What he said to the Pharisees, and I'm putting a we in the blank because we're the audience of the parable too today. He says, we, you guys, we're the tenant farmers. But the landowner isn't Rome. Your problem isn't that you're locked into some kind of economic or political conflict with Rome. Your problem is you are rebelling against heaven's Lord. The land doesn't belong to an investor. The land and your life and every second of it belongs to the Lord your God. And he is the one expecting fruit in due season. We are the tenant farmers, and our fantasy keeps us from living in reality. We know how this story ends, but we keep telling ourselves, well, this time it'll be different. And we rebel against heaven's God. And how do we expect that to end? We ignore heaven's instructions and we say, how do we expect that to end? Well, this time it'll work. This time it'll be different. And Jesus says, how can you possibly expect that? God has laid, and listen to this passage. He quotes from the Old Testament. God has laid a cornerstone, a chief stone upon which he will build his mighty temple. Like the farmer, the owner, had built his tower. God has laid his stone. And you've looked at it and say, no, not that one. I don't like it. I'm going to reject it. He says, how do you expect that to end? If he can drop a cornerstone from heaven, he can drop a rock on your head. Reject the cornerstone and it will crush you. You don't get any choice in this. You are in rebellion, but not against Rome. Rome isn't your problem. God is your problem because you are rebellion against him. Your fantasy is in way of reality, and your rebellion will fail. You cannot pick a fight with the omnipotent creator of the universe and expect to win. And what Jesus is telling him is, when you look at his son and reject him violently, what can you possibly expect? And we know it. What makes this parable powerful is it's not telling anything we don't already know. We know the awful and terrible price of sin and rebellion against God. And we do it anyway. I'm not talking about the Pharisees anymore. Have you picked up on that? We do it anyway. We know the cost of rebellion against God. We know what the cost of our petty sins are and our indulgences and the things that we put aside and say, well, that one doesn't count on Sundays. We know what it costs, and we look at it and we do it anyway. And we expect there to be a different outcome. And Jesus says, God has set his corner. You have two choices. One is the words of the psalm that he quotes. This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. What does that mean? Jesus says option number one is you can decide that whatever God does must be right. Whatever God does must be good. I can look at this confusing, strange thing that God has done and say, I don't understand every bit of it. I don't know why it is the way it is, and yet God has done it, and it is good. It is marvelous in our eyes. Jesus is not the Messiah that I would have drawn on the chart, but he's the one God sent. He must be the one I need. He says, you can look at it and say, this is marvelous in our eyes, or you can be crushed beneath it. But there's only two ways that story can possibly end. And we know it. So what are the crimes of Jesus of Nazareth? The second charge, the second lesson, is simply this. He told us that we are rebels, and that our rebellion will fail. Everybody wants to be the good guy in the story. And everybody likes to retell the story so that they were justified and they were right. And I'm on the side of the angels. And I'm doing what's right. And I've got it worked out. And it's going to succeed in the end. They killed Jesus and we killed Jesus anew and afresh because we don't like that he told us about ourselves. We are the rebels. And our rebellion will fail. When we sin, we have made ourselves the enemy of heaven's God. How can that possibly end any other way? You need to look deeply and seriously at what is going on in your own life and the choices you make and recognize that he's speaking to very religious people. Telling the Pharisees and the scribes a parable is the equivalent to telling this story to a room full of church folk and saying, "Do you realize that we too are the wicked tenant farmers? That we too so often stand in rebellion against God and deceive ourselves into believing we're on the side that wins. Look at what God has done and learn how to say this is marvelous in our eyes. Learn to see Jesus as he is, not as we'd have him to be. Look at his gospel as it is, not as we'd rewrite it, and say this is marvelous in our eyes. Because the God of all creation demands it, and rebellion will fail." We're going to stand and sing a word of invitation. If you find yourself in rebellion against God, do not stand there any longer, but instead submit to him. As we stand and sing, won't you come?